This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm CS. We move now to focus on a largely untold slave revolt, which was in fact the largest such revolt in U.S. history. In a book just out in paperback, Daniel Rasmussen describes the 1811 revolt and points out its significance to the history of both the South and the nation. The story of this slave revolt, Rasmussen writes, is ultimately a story about America, who we are, where we came from, and how our ideals have at times been twisted and cast aside for the sake of greed and power. Rasmussen's book is American Uprising, the Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. When Daniel Rasmussen spoke at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts, he began with the reasons the slaves rose up.
And there are really three reasons the slaves decided to launch this revolt in January of 1811. First was that New Orleans was, as it is now, a bit of a party town. And from Epiphany Sunday up till Mardi Gras, the planters would celebrate the conclusion of harvest with a series of wild and lavish parties in the city. I want to read to you a description of what was consumed at one of those parties. 196 gallons of Madeira, 144 bottles of champagne, 100 bottles of Hermitage wine, 67 bottles of brandy, 81 bottles of porter, 258 bottles of ale, and if that wasn't enough, 11,360 Spanish cigars. The night after a party like that seemed like a pretty good time to launch a slave revolt. The slaves chose January 1811 for a second reason. And that was that America was at war. America was at war with the Spanish. It seems unfamiliar now to think of the Spanish controlling vast amounts of the North American continent, but at the time they controlled everywhere from Florida, Alabama, Texas, Mexico, present-day, and Cuba. And New Orleans was on the fringes of the American empire, surrounded by Spanish territory. And William Claiborne, the American governor, was very conscious of the need to solidify American authority by laying claim to new territories, by securing the American Republic. And so he launched a proxy war with the Spanish over West Florida, which is, you know, present-day Baton Rouge and that area around there. And in the fall of 1810, he'd sent the best American troops, the Dragoons, out of New Orleans to fight the Spanish. And there were rumors in December and January of 1811 that the Spanish were going to launch a counterattack from Cuba. We're going to send troops to try to repulse the Americans and retake the land they lost. And the slaves were keenly aware of these international political developments. They were conscious of these rumors of Spanish intervention, and they chose to launch the revolt at a time when the American military was distracted and when there was hope that outside intervention could help secure any gains they might achieve from a military perspective. The third reason is that in the first weeks of January, a rainstorm blew in, a powerful rainstorm. It's said that by midweek of January 4th, the roads were half a leg deep in mud. This was significant because not only did it mean that the slaves couldn't work, that there was no work to be done on these plantations because, you know, Louisiana is a floodplain, but it meant that heavy artillery could not be transported out from the center of the city out into the plantation territory. So slaves armed with axes, cane knives, and muskets would have a much better chance of success than were they facing a military armed with cannons and the latest artillery. I want to tell you a bit about the leaders of this revolt. One of the prime leaders, a man named Charles Deland. Charles was the son of a white planter and an enslaved mother. It was likely not a consensual relationship. And Charles, because of his light skin, had risen up in the plantation hierarchy to the position of driver. In a slave plantation, it was organized such that there was the master, the overseer, and then slave drivers. And these sugar plantations, which are very complex operations, a slave driver like Charles would have had, you know, required, you know, significant organizational capabilities. He was essentially running a plantation that was operating 24 hours a day all fall, that combined not only harvesting and planting and growing sugar, but building levees and granulating sugar in complex factories. So a man like Charles, you know, was incredibly talented. But he was also working alongside the planters, and the other slaves despised drivers like Charles because of that. They were seen as men who worked in complicity with the system of slavery, and in exchange were given certain privileges, a better cabin, nicer clothes, the ability to travel, the more free ability to marry. And so Charles benefited from all of those privileges. In exchange, he would meet every morning with his master to plot the daily regimen of the sugar plantation. He would punish those recalcitrant slaves, chasing the ones that escaped. And yet Charles was using that privilege not to uphold the system of slavery, but to subvert it. He was, in our modern terminology, the ultimate sleeper cell. And as Charles would travel up and down the coast, he would meet with a few other men. So if we remember, Charles was French-speaking, born in Louisiana. He met first with two other slaves, Kuk and Kwamana, or Kwaku and Kwamina in their native Ashanti tongues, who had been brought over from the west coast of Africa, present-day Ghana, in 1806. Sold into slavery, bought by a planter, James Brown, who was reviled by his fellow planters, who's known as, you know, haughty and arrogant. And there's these wonderful descriptions of him because he was such a sort of, you know, horrendous character. And these men would have been trained from birth as warriors. The Ashanti kingdom was a warlike kingdom, and as soon as you were old enough to walk, you'd be taught to use a spear to fight. And Kuk and Kwamana were no exception. And Kwaku, or Kuk, was particularly interesting because he was over 6 feet tall, which at the age when the average height was, you know, around 5'4", was just this looming giant who naturally commanded the respect of his fellow slaves. And then he would meet even further with a man named Harry Kenner. Harry was an Anglo-American slave brought with his master from the United States down to New Orleans to engage in the work of sugar planting. So already you see an ethnically diverse mix of slaves coming together, Akan slaves, Creole Louisiana slaves, and slaves who are Anglo-American. And they speak English, they speak French, and they also speak their native tongues of Twi or Fanti. And these men came together. What were they talking about? What did they discuss? What political ideals were flowing through the slave quarters that would inspire these men to risk everything about their lives and their families in order to revolt against slave power? Well, first of all, there was the simple brutality of work on a sugar plantation. When slaves talked about being sold south or sold down the river, they meant New Orleans. It was the worst place to be a slave in the United States. The slaves would work during harvest season. They would work 3 8-hour shifts, and then 2 8-hour shifts, sorry, and then sleep for the other. And the system of coercion used to keep these slaves in subordination included tying the slaves' hands to stakes driven in the ground, feet to other stakes, and whipping them to an inch of their lives, torture devices, masks, iron masks over their faces they couldn't eat, iron collars with spikes facing inwards they couldn't sleep. There was one planter who was asked, wrote in his diary, how can we make any money growing sugar when we only work our slaves 16 hours a day? The answer, he wrote, is to consume men and animals. And they did. The average lifespan for a slave from Africa was a mere 7 years. And a slave recouped their initial investment in 4. So it's profitable. In fact, it's a 2 times your money investment to work a slave to death in 8 years. But there was more than that. There was more than a simple revulsion of human nature at coercive mistreatment. There was also another powerful ideology, which was the ideology of radical black republicanism, inspired by the Haitian Revolution. I think today when we think of Haiti, we think of those images that we see on television. But back in 1811, Haiti was a beacon of hope and of liberty to enslaved peoples all across the world. Because Haiti and black Haitians had launched the first successful slave revolt in the history of the New World. And not only had they launched a successful revolt, but they had beaten back the armies of Napoleon Bonaparte, the greatest military emperor Europe had ever seen, defeating 70,000 of his troops that were sent to Haiti to defeat them. And it's, you know, I think difficult to imagine just how groundbreaking Haiti was. You know, no one could have imagined that slaves brought over from Africa, put to work on sugar plantations, would not only revolt, but successfully defeat one of the best armies in all of Europe. I mean, this was shocking and really inspirational to the slaves. And there was an ideology there, an ideology which was anti-imperialist, anti-racist, and anti-slavery. I want to read to you a bit of the Haitian Declaration of Independence just to give you a sense of what was going on, what the tenor of these discussions in the slave quarters, and just exactly what sort of messages were being shared. Jean-Jacques Dessalines wrote in 1804, "Let us imitate those people who, extending their concern into the future and dreading to leave an example of cowardice for posterity, preferred to be exterminated rather than lose their place as one of the world's free peoples." And when he said exterminated, he meant exterminated. General Rochambeau of the French army, among other things, had brought in trained bloodhounds from Cuba who were trained to eat people and had unleashed them on Haiti with the goal of exterminating as many of these slaves as he could. Unfortunately, one of the ironies of history, those bloodhounds could not smell color differences and ended up eating a lot of the French soldiers. And thus, Rochambeau realized that this was perhaps an ineffective strategy. Dessalines went on further. May the French tremble when they approach our coasts, if not by the memory of the cruelty they have inflicted, at least by the terrible resolution that we are about to take to devote to death anyone born French who would dirty with his sacrilegious foot the land of liberty. You know, these were powerful words coming from former sugar slaves who had now declared independence and governed a black republic, an island nation, only hundreds of nautical miles from the coast of New Orleans. How did the slaves know about what was going on in Haiti? Well, in fact, although we might think of plantations as rural and isolated, in fact, they were quite the opposite. Heavily linked in, heavily trafficked. The rivers then were like highways today. And the slaves were constantly in communication, talking about politics, attending dances in the city of New Orleans, meeting together in secret conclaves in the swamps on the edges of the road, and talking constantly about the possibilities of freedom, about Haiti, about broader political trends. In fact, in 1806, they discovered a copy of The Rights of Man and Citizen in the cabins of some of the slaves in the plantation. These men were very politically sophisticated, and they were aware of these international trends. They were aware not only of Haiti, but of this ongoing battle with the Spanish over West Florida. And so they decided to launch their revolt in January of 1811. I can't tell you what Charles Delon said to his men in those final hours before they launched their revolt on the night of January 8th. But I want to read you what another slave, a year later in another revolt, said to his fellow rebels right before he launched a revolt. He said, "Took a sharpened machete and stabbed it through a plantain and shouted to his audience, 'This is how I will run it through the stomachs of the whites.'" And in fact, the masters only asked one slave once after the revolt, "Why did you choose to participate?" And he said, "To go to the city to kill all of the whites." And there is no doubt that such violence was a precondition to the existence of any black republic, any sense of freedom, that violence was simply a necessity. And so in the pouring rain, Charles Delon gathered 25 trusted comrades 40 miles from the gates of New Orleans, out on the plantation of Manuel Andre, a militia leader. In those nights of parties and celebration, Manuel Andre and his son Gilbert were asleep in their beds. Charles and his men burst into their plantation, this gorgeous plantation. Though Andre's plantation does not stand today, many others do. These men were the richest men in all of the United States, surrounded by imported French furniture, family portraits. They break into Andre's second floor, and they kill his son Gilbert with axes. And Manuel Andre awakes to see Charles Delon, his trusted advisor, his loyal driver, his reliable assistant for over a decade, the man he'd trusted to manage his plantation, standing before him with an axe, this plantation tool now transmuted into an icon of insurrection. You can only imagine his emotions at that moment. As he sees his son Gilbert being hacked to death with axes, Andre leaps up and runs for the door. The slaves manage to slice three long cuts into his body, scars that he'll bear with him for the rest of his life. But Andre escapes. I'm not sure how. Perhaps the slaves leave him, thinking that a wounded planter could do them little harm, or perhaps Andre is simply too fast, knows the territory better, and is able to escape these 25 men. It was the slaves' first mistake. Charles and his men then break into Andre's militia storage depot. They gather uniforms, they gather weaponry, ammunition, and armed, they stand outside in his clover field and begin to march towards New Orleans. They have two shouts, two chants, "On to New Orleans" and "Freedom or Death." And shouting that, they begin their march, now dressed in military uniform, armed, marching in military formation, flags flying and drums beating. Francois Trepanier, a planter about 10 miles closer to New Orleans than the Andre plantation, awoke with a start in his bedroom only hours later to see slave Dominique rushing into his room. But Dominique was there not to kill François Trépanier, but to warn him. He tells Trépanier there's a large number of rebel slaves moving down the river, pillaging the farms and killing whites. Trépanier tells Dominique to go travel to New Orleans and to warn every single planter from there all the way to New Orleans for 30 miles to run, to flee, that these rebels are coming. And Dominique proceeds and does just that, passing through the plantations of various men, telling them to flee, and they do. He takes François Trépanier. François Trépanier sends his wife and children. His wife hides in the swamps with his children. But François Trépanier does not, however, choose to flee like all of the other planters. Instead, he decides to take a stand. He thinks that in the face of men he considers little better than animals, men who he has commanded over the past 20 or 30 years as their master, that they will simply turn and leave him be and stop their revolt. In fact, Trépanier was notorious. Local folklore has it that he kept a slave boy named Gustave as a house pet, tossing him scraps of food and treating him like a dog. And so he took up a stand on that cold January morning up on the second floor of his plantation. He did not have to wait long, and what he saw must have been a great surprise. No ragtag band of slave criminals, no rioting band of sugar workers, but rather an army, 100 to 200 strong at this point, marching in formation, dressed in military uniforms, beating drums, flying flags. These were men who were saying, we're no longer slaves. We're free men. And not only are we free men with a real political vision. And we're here to conquer New Orleans. It was a bold statement, and it must have come as a complete surprise to Trépanier. Cook or Kwaku led the charge up into Trepanier's home. They kill Trépanier, too, with an axe. Local legend has it said that Gustave swung an axe in addition, exacting some final vengeance from his years of patronizing mistreatment. You can actually go out and see Trepanier's grave out on the German coast, right by Red Church, and it says in French, here lies François Trépanier, killed by insurgent slaves in 1811. But if you read the history books, at least up until 1945 or so, they all say that François Trépanier successfully beat back his slaves, which is just one example of the many reasons why this slave revolt, even now on the bicentennial of the largest act of armed resistance against slavery in the United States, has gone unnoticed.
That's the voice of Daniel Rasmussen speaking about his book, American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt, which took place in 1811. Edmund Russell and Active Ingredients Media provided the audio of Rasmussen's talk in South Hadley, Massachusetts. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. Let's return to more of Rasmussen's presentation.
I think people often wonder, did the slaves have any chance of success? At this moment, as this slave army stood 25 miles from the gates of New Orleans, was this some crazed gambit? Or did these men have any real hope? If Haiti was, you know, our template, then I think it would be right to argue that they did have a chance. If Haitian slaves could defeat the armies of Napoleon Bonaparte, why could not then these Louisiana slaves defeat the armies of America, a much younger and weaker country? But I think we ultimately need more evidence just than a parallel story, some evidence that we could balance, that we could weigh and say, well, this group of men was up against this group of men, and let's weigh their chances of success according to the primary sources. And so I actually went down to the archives in D.C., and I spent a week or two combing through every single naval and military record about Louisiana, trying to find some snippet, something that would give me some clue as to whether this burning question, did the slaves have any chance of success? And I found a few things. The first was an account from a Louisiana newspaper. It said the accounts we received were various. Fear and panic had seized those making their escape, and it was not possible to estimate the force of the brigands. Other newspaper accounts suggested that men called this a miniature representation of the horrors of Saint-Domingue, Saint-Domingue being the French name for Haiti. But there was more. I finally found, after combing through, reams of naval records, one letter from Commodore John Shaw, who was the Commodore of the American Navy stationed in New Orleans. And he wrote that in the city at the time, on that day, on January 9th, there were a mere 68 American troops in New Orleans. And he calls them a quote-unquote weak detachment. And he says that quote-unquote panic and dismay seized everyone in the city. And that a general sense of desperation, they feared that all sorts of property would be laid waste by the rioters, that property would be consumed, and that there would be a general massacre. He went on to say that he feared that the Americans had little chance of success. And what happened next just confirmed the weakness of this American military troops, of these 68 regular troops protecting a defenseless city. A city where, Commodore Shaw pointed out, barely a single man or woman possessed a musket for his defense. And so these 68 regular troops march out to face the slave rebels, to protect New Orleans, to meet those slaves in the fields of battle. And they encounter those slaves at 2 a.m., holed up in a plantation that sits on the site of Louis Armstrong International Airport. They come upon, at about 2 a.m., this plantation. The lights are burning, they can smell burned chicken, and they know that the slaves are there. And so they prepare. They prepare an elaborate attack to lay siege, to defeat the slaves right then, right there. And led by General Wade Hampton, they attack, only to find that the plantation was empty. The whole thing was a ruse. The slaves, using classic guerrilla warfare tactics brought over from West Africa, were using a classic trick to lure the enemy out from the centers of power, to use feints and mock attacks and retreats to confuse the enemy and then to wear them down, to harass them, and then ultimately to kill them in territory that they knew better. And so they had succeeded in their first military encounter, having lured the Americans out of the city, had them attack an empty plantation. And then it was the Americans who decided, rather than going further, they would stop and rest. It's often a trope when you read narratives of other slave revolts. Generally, the planters and militia commanders write about the slaves resting and taking a break and thus giving themselves an opportunity. But here it was the Americans that rested, the American military, too tired, tricked by their own slaves. But as I said before, the slaves had made one mistake. They had let Manuel Andry live. After escaping from his plantation and escaping from the rebels, Manuel Andry crosses the river and meets with Charles Perret, a planter on the other side of the river where no revolt is unfolding. Knowing their livelihoods at stake, that their entire world was built on slavery. In the words of John Noel Destrehan, who wrote and I think best captured this dynamic, he said, "Without chattel slavery, cultivation must cease, the improvements of a century be destroyed, and the great river resume its empire over our ruined fields and demolished habitations. Without chattel slavery, New Orleans would not exist. These slave plantations would not exist. The wealth of sugar, this abundance of sugar and the wealth resulting from it would not exist." And so these men, armed to the teeth, cross the river to fight their slaves, men who are now free by virtue of the force of arms. Charles Perret says in his letter, he recounts that he saw the slaves moving, quote-unquote, by forced march towards the high ground on the Bernoulli estate. "We saw the enemy at a very short distance, as many mounted as on foot. At this point, eyewitnesses said there were between 200 and 500 armed rebels." What did those rebels do now facing a well-armed military force in a field of battle chosen not by them, but by circumstance, flanked unwittingly by this planter militia? A Spanish spy in New Orleans recalls what happened next. "The blacks were not intimidated by this army and formed themselves in a line," he wrote. "This is exactly the right thing to do from a military perspective, to form a firing line, to wait for your enemy to approach and then to fire your muskets once you could see the whites of their eyes." How could they have felt standing there facing that battle? We'll never know. The slaves were preparing for battle, not taking notes. But I want to read to you a brief passage written by another slave, not a participant in this revolt, who fights for the Union Army in the Civil War from these same Louisiana sugar plantations. He writes, "We are now fighting and ask no more glorious death than to die for freedom. But for our race to go back into bondage again, to be hunted by dogs through the swamps and cane breaks, to be set upon the block and sold for gold and silver, no, never, gladly we would die first. Those men who stood there on that field of battle, there on those sugar plantations of Bernard Bernoulli, made that exact decision, that same decision that Jean-Jacques Dessalines had laid out, to choose, rather than to leave an example of cowardice for posterity, to prefer to die for freedom, and to leave a legacy of heroism and martyrdom. What happened next, I cannot exactly tell you. Battles then were chaotic. As soon as the guns were fired, smoke billowed to such an extent that fighting in the 1810s, 20s, 30s, even up until the Civil War, you would rarely, if ever, even see those people you were shooting at. The smoke was just too intense. All you would hear were these cacophonous noises, the sound of bullets buzzing like bees past your head, and then the sight of your comrades falling beside you. And I can't tell you whether it is that the slaves ran out of ammunition, or perhaps they fired their weapons too early. Perhaps the militia was simply better prepared, better armed. But whatever happened, the planters broke the slave line. And what happened next is one of the worst and most horrific massacres that has occurred in the history of this country. The planters, at that point, right there on the field of battle, killed 40 to 60 slaves. And after killing them, they beheaded those slaves. And they carried their heads to the levee, where they put them on poles. The planter Samuel Hambleton wrote in his letter, "The slaves were brung here for the sake of their heads, which decorate our levee all the way up the coast. They look like crows sitting on long poles." The planters capture Charles Deland, the leader of the revolt, in the woods. They chop off all of his limbs, shoot him in both thighs, and then burn him alive. And then they behead him, too, and put his head on a pole along the levee. The planters then do something, I think, that's quite interesting. They capture 21 slaves out on the plantations, an additional about 15 or 20 in New Orleans, and they put them on trial. Why are they putting these slaves on trial? Well, I think the answer was written from the beginning. They were going to find these slaves guilty. This was a kangaroo court. And I can read to you a passage which I think is indicative of the attitude towards which they held these trials. "These rebels testified against one another, charging one another with capital crimes such as rebellion, assassination, arson, pillaging, etc., etc., etc." They literally write etc., etc., etc. in the court transcripts. They don't care what it is they're charging the slaves with. All they care is that they establish that the rule of law is back in force, that they, having descended into these depths of savagery, having dismembered 100 corpses and dangled those dismembered corpses from the central square of New Orleans, put those heads on pikes, they're trying to say, we are justified. The law is on our side. These men were criminals, and we are righteous in what our actions are. And we are using these court trials to reaffirm our own humanity, our own sense of civilization, in the face of men we consider little better than animals. And so after those trials, sure enough, they kill all of the slaves on trial. There are a few, actually, who they find innocent, mainly those who testify against the others to such an extent or give them enough information that they're able to kill many more. And they put their heads, too, on poles, this same savage ritual. But they did interview the slaves over the course of these trials, and those transcripts were very valuable to me as I wrote this account. And the story that emerged from those transcripts is not the story of a band of criminals, or brigands, as they're called, nor is it the story, I think, of a battle of civilization versus the savage. Rather, it's a story of a multi-ethnic coalition of enslaved men, incredibly organized, 11 separate leaders, men from Louisiana, the Congo, the Ashanti Kingdom, Kentucky, Virginia, names that are French, German, Spanish, West African, and Anglo-American, all coming together. The politics of the slave quarters is complex and Atlantic. No single ideology, no single leader define the insurgents or their agenda. Rather, inspired by a radical black republicanism that emphasized equality and liberty, these men were fighting for a really political aims that are demonstrated by their choice to march in uniform, flying flags, beating drums, and by their chance onto New Orleans and freedom or death. Yet in the wake of this revolt, that story of revolutionaries, of armed men willing to fight and die for liberty, freedom, and equality, is not the story that went into the historical record. Rather, in the letters and newspaper accounts of the planters and the military commanders in the city, the story that was sent back to Washington, that was distributed to newspapers around the country, was a story of a quote-unquote horde of brigands, of rioters, men who had simply been lawbreakers, not revolutionaries, but lawbreakers, and of an insignificant event easily suppressed by the American military. An American military who we know from Wade Hampton's own records was resting on a plantation 10 miles away from the battle that took place. And yet, those masters of spin told a story that has lasted in the history books, even to the present day. And yet, despite this story's absence from the textbooks, despite the fact that there's a vast collective amnesia about the largest slave revolt in American history today in this country, nevertheless, I would argue that the story of this 1811 revolt is central to understanding the history of this country. It's a story about American expansion and the costs of American expansion and the foundations of American authority in the South. But more importantly, it's a story of a revolution organized by enslaved men, men who saw violence as a means to an end they never realized. But their failure to achieve those goals does not mean that they did not have goals or that the sum total of this event was the suppression, the quick and easy suppression of a horde of brigands. Rather, 200 years later, we must reckon with the politics of the enslaved, with the world that the slaves made, and with the humanity and indeed heroism of those who fought against slave power. To recognize this event, central, I would argue, in shaping the history of New Orleans and the South, as an event significant not only to the history of slavery, not only to black history, but to American history, and not only because Charles de Lon and Cook and Quamana were men who I think whose actions stand as a testament to the best ideals of this country, a belief in liberty and equality and justice for all, and yet who, ironically, for their belief in those ideals and for their willingness to stand up for those ideals, were executed, dismembered, their corpses put on display. But we must remember this story. Because only through understanding the stories of Charles, of Cook and Quamana, of placing them too as central figures in our understanding of our past, alongside those much more familiar names like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, only then, I would argue, can we begin to comprehend the true history of Louisiana, the South, and with it, the nation.
That is the voice of Daniel Rasmussen, author of American Uprising, The Untold Story of America's Largest Slave Revolt. The book began, interestingly, as a senior thesis Rasmussen wrote at Harvard University. Many thanks to ActiveIngredients.org. This is CS, suggesting the important thing is not stop questioning, and we will look for you next time.